So why don't we have a word of prayer as we get started and ask God to make this a really productive time this afternoon of dialogue. I thought the program yesterday afternoon was done in just the right spirit. We are not trying to discourage vigorous debate. We're not trying to discourage people from saying what they really think. But we want it to be done in a way that reflects charity and humility and civility. And I think we can have a good, robust discussion without it becoming sort of testy in the way that things sometimes do. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the time we've had here so far in the conference. We thank you for this afternoon that we can be here to further continue this discussion of faith science issues, talking particularly about questions having to do with what is the nature of nature and what does it tell us about your existence. And even amongst Christians, that's a question that's often one that people hold different opinions. We pray that as we discuss this afternoon, you will help us to see more clearly what the real truth of the matter is, and that you will help us to discuss with Christian charity and humility as we visit this afternoon. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay, our first speaker probably needs no introduction to at least half of you. But since half of you are here for the first time and maybe haven't been to ASA meetings before and don't know all the people who are very active, Lauren Harsma is a very, very active member in ASA, has been for many years. He's a professor of physics at Calvin College and before that, or Calvin University now? Or is it Calvin College? Okay, so a college is content to call itself a college. So many call themselves universities when they really aren't, just because it's trendy, and I appreciate Calvin. That's their self-designation, and they're happy to stick with it, Calvin College, where he teaches physics. He has an active research program there. He got his Ph.D. from Harvard and also is married to a scientist who many of you know, Deborah, who is on the program Friday, the workshop, if you were here for the half-day workshop, and works in astronomy. So we're very happy to have Lauren come. Let me go ahead and introduce Bruce. We're glad that Bruce is here with us to fill in for Steve Meyer. I think most of you met Bruce yesterday afternoon, at least know a little bit about his background. He actually taught at Baylor at one time and is a person whose background is, he has a strong scientific background, but I think his Ph.D. work is more in philosophy of science, if I'm not mistaken. And he therefore covers a broad spectrum of understanding science, but understanding a lot of philosophy, which many scientists don't. So we're very, very pleased that he can be here as a stand-in for Steve Meyer. Steve Meyer sends his apologies. His son was found to have a very critical heart problem. His son's 12 years old. This was last Saturday. And they have some family urgencies and emergencies connected with that that have prevented him from being here. But I think he and Bruce have had a chance to talk at length about... Not at length, okay. I think he had prepared a lot of his stuff, and so Bruce is, I think, primed to be Steve Meyer, okay, more or less, okay? Less, but not a whole lot less. Let's put a, come on, let's be optimistic, okay? I think this is going to be a great time. Lauren, come on up and get us started on this discussion.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Could I have two volunteers take the stack of handouts right there and pass them out, and then when any leftovers, when you get to the end, just put them on chairs by the door for people who walk in late. This is not my PowerPoint. That's Bruce's. So while the handout is going around, by way of introduction, certain criticisms of intelligent design and theistic evolution are frequently repeated, and if you're on certain email lists, you've probably heard them many, many times. And I think that these criticisms often arise from common oversimplifications and misunderstandings of intelligent design and theistic evolution. So our goal, is to promote more nuanced and accurate understandings of these. Now, I'm going to start by laying out some traditional theological points regarding God's governance of nature, points which I think almost all ID advocates and almost all theistic evolution advocates would agree. So on your handout up at the top, common theology of God's governance of nature. First, matter, energy, space, time are not co-eternal with God. God created them out of nothing. Second, God designed the properties of matter, energy, space, and time, and the fundamental laws of nature so that these natural mechanisms built into the universe would accomplish God's desired outcomes. Third, natural laws and matter, energy, and space, and time do not now exist independently of God. Rather, God continually sustains the natural world in existence moment by moment. Fourth, created things have real creaturely cause and effect powers granted by God, but God also concurs with natural cause and effect. Nothing can take place apart from God's will or without God's cooperation with the created world. Now, this view is sometimes called concurrence. It's probably the most common view among both intelligent design and theistic evolution advocates. There's another traditional Christian view called occasionalism, which maintains that created things do not have their own cause and effect powers, but whatever happens is directly caused by God. Creaturely actions are merely the occasions of divine activity. Now, both concurrence and occasionalism are compatible with both ID and TE, so I just include them both here for the sake of completeness. Fifth, God is not only sovereign over scientifically predictable natural events, but also over scientifically unpredictable or random events. You can think of Proverbs 16:33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Now, this is relevant to evolutionary biology because mutations, natural disasters, and other natural mechanisms important for evolution include elements which are scientifically unpredictable. And it's also relevant for other scientific fields. Like meteorology, ecology, developmental biology, pathology, where important natural mechanisms include elements which are scientifically unpredictable. The views not between ID and TE, but within each view. Regarding these scientifically unpredictable events, some would say God chooses the outcome of every single scientifically unpredictable event. Some would say that while God could choose the outcome of every event, God chooses instead to grant creation the freedom to be itself and explore through random processes some of the possibilities built into it. God knows the range of possibilities. God knows that these processes will produce an outcome within the range of his will. And some would advocate an intermediate view between these two, saying God doesn't directly choose the outcome of every scientifically unpredictable event, but does so occasionally at strategic or important points to ensure particular things happen. Sixth, whether or not God chose to miraculously supersede natural laws during pre-human biological history, God definitely acted miraculously and in special revelatory ways in human history. Now, okay, these points aren't agreed on by everyone, aren't even necessarily every Christian, but these theological beliefs are shared by many advocates of intelligent design and many advocates of theistic evolution. They're going to form a common basis from which we'll carry out today's discussion. Now, I'm going to talk briefly about intelligent design, but then turn it over to Bruce Gordon to do most of it. He'll talk briefly about theistic evolution and hand it off to me. Since the term intelligent design is used in a variety of ways, I should define how I'm going to use it. I'm not referring to cosmological or fine-tuning arguments of design. I'm not referring to so-called rare earth arguments. I'm not referring to arguments which point to the natural world and make an intuitive argument towards apparent design and how everything fits together in a way that could be compatible with biological evolution. All these are sometimes discussed under the banner of ID, and for today I'm going to leave those aside and focus on what I believe is a primary source of contention. I'm going to use ID in what I believe is the most common use of the term, the one that causes the most debates. Intelligent design is a set of beliefs and arguments that the development of first life, plus some subsequent novel developments and increases in biological complexity during pre-human biological history, cannot be explained via natural evolutionary mechanisms alone, and is best explained in terms of some intelligent agent acting during biological history in ways beyond ordinary evolutionary mechanisms. Now, as I say, in recent years, certain criticisms of ID have been frequently repeated in books, articles, blogs, emails. I've heard them many times, and I believe they're unfair because they oversimplify ID theory and because they're overgeneralized to apply to all ID advocates, and I'll call them myths about ID. Number one, intelligent design just isn't science. Number two, intelligent design is a science stopper. Myth three, intelligent design is just creationism in disguise. Myth four, intelligent design has a theology of God of the gaps or episodic deism. Now, these myths are common because, let's be honest, several of them are in fact true about some ID writings and some ID advocates some of the time. But they are not intrinsically or necessarily true about ID theory, and I say it's false. At times, it's literally bearing false witness to say or imply that these are always true about all ID advocates. Now, considerable energy has been spent debating should ID be considered scientific. I believe these debates about what is science and what isn't have been unproductive because intelligent design as a whole package is partly scientific, partly philosophical, partly religious. There's various ways to separate the claims. On your handout is a way I personally like to do it. There's a scientific claim. It's extremely improbable that first life could have self-organized via known natural processes. It's extremely probable that certain subsequent increases in biological complexity could have evolved via known natural processes. There's what I would call a philosophical claim. Some would like to say, well, it's mostly scientific. I'm going to call it philosophical for now. It goes like this. Many events are improbable without being intelligently designed, but some events are both improbable and intelligently designed. If the preceding scientific claim is true, then life and biological complexity have other features which make the most reasonable explanation for their existence that some sort of intelligent agent acted during biological history. Alternative explanations, in terms of chance or multiple universes or some as yet unknown natural law, are possible but far less plausible. There's a philosophy of science claim. A scientific investigation of the world need not always limit itself to naturalistic mechanisms. Under certain particular circumstances, and when studying particular events, an explanation in terms of actions by intelligent agents could be acceptable and useful in scientific progress. You can make analogies, for example, to forensic science. There's often a religious claim for most ID advocates. God acted miraculously in biological history to create first life and cause some increases in biological complexity. There's often a theological claim that there are theological reasons for expecting God, that God acted miraculously in biological history, and an apologetic claim that intelligent design is a good approach for combating atheism in the culture. Now, some people challenge the theological claim of intelligent design on theological grounds, and some people challenge the scientific claim of ID on scientific grounds, and I think that's extremely legitimate, and ID advocates should welcome such critiques as ways to sharpen their thinking. But in my experience, those are not the most common criticisms of ID. The most common criticisms are what I call the four myths. Now, laying out these different claims the way I did gives you an outline of my thinking here. ID is not just creationism in disguise because the first three claims on the handout really can be evaluated apart from the three religious claims. ID is partly scientific because the scientific claim can and ought to be thoroughly investigated by the methods of science. A very large fraction of the criticisms of ID are aimed at those philosophical claims, the philosophical and philosophy of science. Now, I happen to believe that those claims are highly defensible and probably true, at least when phrased in certain ways, even though I happen to believe that the scientific claim is probably false. So, in my full paper, and the URL for that is at the top of your handout, I argue at some length why I believe these four myths about ID are unfair when applied to ID as a whole. But now I'm going to turn it over to Bruce Gordon so he can give his understanding of what ID is and is not.
I neglected to mention Bruce got his PhD in philosophy of science at Northwestern University and now is at the Discovery Institute. We're glad that Bruce Gordon's here, and he was formerly at Baylor before going to the Discovery Institute. Thank you.
Thank you, Walter. All right. Well, I am, I think, happy to step in for Steve Meyer. You may not be so happy by the time I'm done, but we'll do the best that we can here. Stay close to the mic. Closer. Is this close enough? All right, then. Well, for better or worse, intelligent design has been in the news a fair bit over the last few years. Much of it has been for the worse, as far as the actual reportage in the stories, as far as we're concerned. But nonetheless, it has captured a bit of attention and has been the focus of discussion. So we're going to focus a little bit on some of the myths associated with intelligent design. But it's not exactly something that's foreign to the history of science. If you go back to one of the greats in the history of physics, Isaac Newton, he actually wrote more theology than he wrote on scientific matters, but his perspective with regard to what he was doing was framed in words like these, from the General Scholium to the Principia. Referring to the solar system, though these bodies may indeed continue in their orbits by the mere laws of gravity, yet they could by no means have at first derived the regular position of the orbits themselves from those laws. Thus, this most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. So recognition that initial conditions and not just laws of nature are relevant to determining the properties of physical systems, and those initial conditions sometimes have to be fine-tuned in order to yield the results that are conducive to life. And I'm not sure that Newton appreciated the fullness of that, but some of the privileged planet hypothesis certainly does, recognizing circumstellar habitable zones and so on and so forth. But in the 19th century in particular, there arose another perception of nature, mostly associated with biology and the founder of evolutionary biology in many ways, Charles Darwin. Now, there seems to be no more design in the variability of organic beings and in the action of natural selection than in the course in which the wind blows. Or a more modern representative, Richard Dawkins, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Keyword, of course, being appearance. So the appearance of design, then, in living organisms, in the neo-Darwinian picture, has resulted from purely undirected natural processes, most importantly, natural selection supervening on random genetic mutation. So the various definitions of biological evolution that we can consider, the first two are certainly compatible with intelligent design. Evolution is change over time, evolution in terms of universal common descent, that there's one tree of life, monophyly. Natural selection, operating on random genetic mutation, we would regard as incompatible with intelligent design. It's essentially an undirected process. So what is the theory of intelligent design? As you've probably heard stated many times, it's the theory that certain features of the universe and of living systems are best explained as the result of an intelligent cause rather than an undirected natural process, like brute chance within the matrix of physical law or natural selection and acting on random variation. So those systems look designed because they were, in fact, designed, is the fundamental perspective. And so the question becomes, is design real or is it illusory? Well, I think the title was four conceptions about misconceptions about intelligent design. I have five here. The second and the third are actually probably can be merged into one. Intelligent design is an argument from ignorance or a God of the gaps fallacy of some sort. Intelligent design is not science. Intelligent design is not testable. Intelligent design is based on religion and really amounts to nothing more than creationism in a cheap tuxedo. Or intelligent design is incompatible with all forms of theistic evolution. And all of those things are misrepresentations or misunderstandings. So let's take them up one at a time. So intelligent design is an argument from ignorance. Actually, it's not. It's an argument from what we know intelligent causes are capable of producing, and an examination of the causal sufficiency of undirected material mechanisms. So with respect to the origin of life, for instance, we can look at things in terms of random chemical interactions within a primordial soup and try to explain things by chance. We can look at various self-organizational scenarios in chemistry and biochemistry and see if that might give us a basis for explaining the origin of biological information. We can combine those strategies to try to explain the specified complexity of information that's associated with DNA, for instance. And intelligent design is also an option. We know that intelligence is habitually associated with the creation of specified complex information. So essentially what we're doing is establishing multiple competing hypotheses and examining the explanatory power that each of them have with respect to the phenomena that we're attempting to explain. And, of course, the thesis of intelligent design, particularly with respect to the origin of life, is that the only thing we know to be causally sufficient to the production of the complex specified information at the basis of life is intelligence. None of these other things have been demonstrated to this point capable of producing such things, and there are principled reasons for thinking that they are not capable of generating that kind of information. So, is it an argument from ignorance? This is what Michael Shermer had to say in the Ottawa Citizen last year. Intelligent design argues that life is too specifically complex, complex structures with specific functions like DNA, and irreducibly complex, reference to Mike Behe's thesis, to have evolved by natural forces. Therefore, life must have been created by an intelligent designer. So he's asserting that the argument looks like this. Natural processes couldn't have produced the event that we observe, therefore, intelligent design. And that's not actually the argument. As I was intimating a moment ago, the structure of the ID argument actually looks like this. Natural processes are causally insufficient to the phenomenon in question. Intelligent causes are sufficient to the phenomenon in question. Therefore, given causal sufficiency, we refer from the effect back to the cause, and causal uniqueness renders it an even stronger inference to intelligent design. So it looks rather like this. We've got three hypotheses that are causally insufficient and one that is, and based on our knowledge of the causal power of competing types of entities or processes, we infer that ID is the proper explanation, or the best explanation, at least, for complex specified information. And similarly, you know, we wouldn't attempt to explain the markings on the Rosetta Stone or various Egyptian hieroglyphs by wind and erosion. We would infer an intelligent cause, because wind and erosion are insufficient, is an insufficient causal basis for producing the kind of markings that we observe. So misconception number two, intelligent design isn't science. Well, this gets us into a whole kind of thorny area talking about how do we distinguish science from non-science? What are the demarcation criteria, the necessary and sufficient conditions for something to be science? And philosophers of science have pretty much exhausted that discussion. And the conclusion has been that really there are no definitive, necessary, and sufficient conditions across the board universally that we can apply to a definition of science. So some sciences, for example, seek to provide causal explanations of natural phenomena, but others merely provide mathematical descriptions of them. Some sciences seek to discover natural laws. Others try to reconstruct past events. Some sciences perform controlled laboratory experiments. Others do not. Some sciences name, classify, and organize natural objects. Others explain general categories of events, often by reference to natural laws or general theories. Some sciences construct simplified and idealized models of natural phenomena, and others do not. Some sciences study repeatable phenomena. Some do not. Some study singular historical events. Some sciences assess their theories by making predictions. Others test their theories by evaluating their explanatory power in the manner that I was just illustrating, or some use both. Some sciences test theories in isolation. Others compare the predictive or explanatory power of competing hypotheses in an effort to determine the best explanation. Some sciences study only what can be directly observed, and other sciences make inferences about entities or processes that cannot be observed directly and are only known through the effects that they're postulated to have. Some sciences reason deductively. Some reason inductively. Some reason abductively, that is, from effect to cause. And some use all three modes of inference. So given that kind of diversity in the sciences, how could one argue in regard to any evidence-based mode of rational explanation that it is or isn't science? Any defense or rejection of something as scientific or unscientific, respectively, requires a definition of science, and there are no universal, necessary, and sufficient criteria in the offing for this purpose. So, some would suggest, well, maybe methodological naturalism. So we have to consider only multiple competing naturalistic hypotheses. But if we have a well-defined methodology for inferring that an intelligent cause has been operative, on what grounds are we going to exclude it except definitionally? And if we do it definitionally, then we're either begging the question against ideas and explanation by saying, well, all explanations count as scientific except intelligent design, or in constructing a definition, we're just arbitrarily ruling something out of court that may, in fact, be a better explanation than the natural explanations that are in the offing. And what we're really concerned about, one would think, as scientists, is what's true, not what satisfies a canned definition of what science is. So, let's consider some of the evidence. Fred Hoyle remarked that a common sense interpretation of the data suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. And we talked a little bit about multiverse cosmology yesterday as an attempt to get around an ID inference with respect to cosmological fine-tuning. But just to make the point, you can think of the universe as having been produced by a universe-creating machine. And if you're going to have one that is compatible with life, you have to get the dials set just right for particular settings, for strengths of various forces, the form of various laws, so on and so forth. One of the more startling examples is that of the cosmological constant, which is fine-tuned to 120 decimal places. The force of gravity, in respect of the full range of the strengths of the laws of nature, presumably it could have had a different strength. And the strengths that we observe vary over 40 orders of magnitude. But if you consider what even a small difference in the force of gravity would create in terms of its effects in relation to that whole range, then moving it a small amount would render life as we know it impossible, either stronger or weaker. Mike Behe's example of the bacterial flagellar motor and various other kinds of irreducible complexity in nature. Functionally integrated systems such that the removal of even one component renders non-functional. And some have suggested that the type 3 secretory system might be an evolutionary antecedent to the bacterial flagellar motor. It's actually looking now like it's a devolutionary byproduct, that it is a result of loss of function, not the result of gaining function. Scott Minnick and Steve Meyer have a paper coming out in the next while dealing with that. And there's a preliminary version of it that was published a few years ago that's available on the Discovery website. In any case, the information in DNA. Michael Polanyi in the late 1960s in Chemical and Engineering News wrote an article called Life Transcending Physics and Chemistry that essentially made a point that materialist science has yet to come to grips with, namely that the sequencing of the nucleotide bases along the sugar phosphate backbone of the DNA molecule is chemically independent of the background. The bonds are not selective in any way, any more than the chemistry of ink bonding to paper explains the content of your morning newspaper. The information content of the DNA molecule cannot be explained on a chemical basis in terms of the chemistry of the nucleotide being attached to the sugar phosphate backbone. And that's integral, incidentally, to the information carrying capacity of DNA. So, with respect to whether ID is science, you have a model of multiple competing hypotheses for these various things, and that fits into the structure of how arguments proceed in sciences, particularly the historical sciences. Charles Lyell, who was an inspiration to Darwin and one of the founders of modern geology, argued from a principle of uniformitarianism. The subtitle of his book on principles of geology was being an attempt to explain the former changes of the Earth's surface by references to causes now in operation. And so you ask, what is the cause now presently in operation that's sufficient to the production of complex specified information? It's intelligence. The creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. Henry Koestler was an Origin of Life researcher. Okay, are people having trouble hearing me? Move the mic over this way. Okay. And then stay there. All right. I'm afraid of the mic. I keep moving it. Okay. If you want to go into those arguments more deeply, Steve explores them at length in his book, Signature in the Cell, which was just released in June. Misconception three, intelligent design isn't testable. Well, we've just explained how it might be tested by a method of multiple competing hypotheses and a strategy of inference to the best explanation. That's a common strategic way of approaching things in science. How about its predictive capacity? What about things like, for example, junk DNA? Well, back in 2006, Michael Shermer again says, rather than being intelligently designed, the human genome looks more and more like a mosaic of mutations, fragment copies, borrowed sequences, and discarded strings of DNA that were jerry-built over millions of years of evolution. Well, no, not really. ID advocates have advanced a different view of DNA, particularly of the non-protein coding DNA. The theory of intelligent design predicted years ago that most of the non-protein coding sequences in the genome should perform some biological function, even if they don't direct protein synthesis. ID theorists do not deny that mutational processes might have degraded or broken some previously functional DNA, but we predict that the functional DNA, the signal, should dwarf the non-functional DNA, the noise, and not the reverse. As Bill Dembski explained and predicted in 1998, on an evolutionary view, we expect a lot of useless DNA. If, on the other hand, organisms are designed, we expect DNA as much as possible to exhibit function. The discovery in recent years that non-protein coding DNA performs a diversity of important biological functions has confirmed this prediction. More specifically, recent scientific discoveries have shown, now this is a passage from Steve's book, and each of these 10 points has a footnote to references in the literature. Recent scientific discoveries have shown that the non-protein coding regions of the genome direct the production of RNA molecules that regulate the use of the protein coding regions of DNA. Cell and genome biologists have also discovered that these supposedly useless non-protein coding regions of the genome, one, regulate DNA replication, two, regulate transcription, three, mark sites for programmed rearrangement of genetic material, four, influence the proper folding and maintenance of chromosomes, five, control the interactions of chromosomes with the nuclear membrane and matrix, six, control RNA processing, editing, and splicing, seven, modulate translation, eight, regulate embryological development, 9, repair DNA, and 10, aid in immunodefense or fighting disease, among other functions. In some cases, junk DNA has even been found to code functional genes. Overall, the non-protein coding regions in the genome function much like an operating system in a computer that can direct multiple operations simultaneously. And again, that argument is developed much further in the book. Fourth misconception, intelligent design is based on religion. So you have this Time magazine cover from 2005. Read the small print. It says, the push to teach intelligent design raises a question. Does God have a place in the science classroom? Of course, it also, that whole Dover incident was something that Discovery was opposed to in its and tried to counsel the Dover School Board from proceeding along the course that they were going, but to no avail, they went ahead anyway, and the debacle followed. It's never been Discovery's policy that ID should be taught in the classroom. Merely that the controversy and the different perspectives that are developing on evolutionary theory, such as the one I just illustrated with respect to junk DNA, should be taught in the classroom. That's what the slogan, "Teach the Controversy," is intended to refer to. In any case, the perception is that teaching ID would be teaching religion. Well, that's conflating the evidence with the implications. So if you think about the history of cosmology and the way that the Big Bang Theory was resisted when it first was introduced, it was dismissed in a derisory fashion because it was regarded as requiring a transcendent cause. It seemed to imply the existence of God, and scientists weren't comfortable with introducing something like that as an explanation within science. Nonetheless, the mathematical structure of general relativity and the proof of the singularity theorems and the discovery of the Hubble expansion in the 20s and the prediction of the cosmic microwave background by George Gamow in the late 40s and its subsequent discovery in the mid-1960s by Penzias and Wilson, all of those things led to the acceptance of the theory. Its overwhelming theoretical power and its observational support, it was accepted as science despite its theistic implications. And one might say that if ID becomes accepted as science, it will be for similar reasons. Yes, it has theistic implications, but what is the theoretical model and what is the evidence? And if it holds up and it's strong enough, I think we're going to see a similar sort of recognition, okay, this is a viable way of doing science. It's producing some interesting results. We're comfortable, maybe not entirely, but we will grudgingly welcome it into the scientific pantheon of possible explanations. And so, for example, you have lifelong atheist Anthony Flew, who, if it had been an essentially religious argument, I think would have rejected it, but he appreciated the implications of the evidence, and as a consequence has moved, he's not a Christian, but he has moved into a broadly deistic or theistic understanding of the universe. So, the implications of intelligent design: it challenges a materialistic worldview, and it supports a theistic worldview. And then lastly, there's the idea that intelligent design is incompatible with all forms of theistic evolution, and that just isn't so. We might try to develop a taxonomy or breakdown of how we might think of things in terms of God's activity and whether it's detectable. So, one view: God is active since the creation of the universe, and biological design is detectable. Now, one version of that might be the directed continuous development of the universe and of life. So you have the standard evolutionary sequence of development, more complex species developing from less complex species, but that's an intelligently directed process that is detectable. So you have that continuity there. That's a form of theistic evolution as well. Another possibility would be a directed discontinuous development of life, so that there are discrete injections of information into the biosphere that advance the development of life. That's consistent with ID. Theistic evolutionists are probably not going to be as happy with that picture. Another possibility: God's active since the creation of the universe, and biological design is not detectable. Well, that's consistent with ID insofar as it regards God as being active, but the denial of detectability is inconsistent with ID. Nonetheless, a good many theistic evolutionists would probably be happy with this picture. So we don't have any smoking gun, so to speak, in terms of a design detectant methodology that's applicable on this view. But creation somehow witnesses to God's activity through secondary causation. And principles of development that make evolution from the simple to the complex on this view probable. And you might appeal to various sorts of evidence like convergent evolution and some Simon Conway Morris's way of looking at things. So a third option, God has not been active since the creation of the universe, and biological design is detectable. That's a somewhat stranger view, but you could associate it with the front-loading hypothesis. God packed everything into the initial conditions of the universe. Or you could add an epicycle to that and say God packed everything into the initial conditions of the universe and then again into the origins of life. All of the information was front-loaded, and then subsequent development followed according to plan. And it's detectable because we can observe the directionality of it. And then lastly, the strangest view of all, God has not been active since the creation of the universe, and biological design is not detectable. Well, that would be kind of like a picture of God being a Jackson Pollock sort of painter. He sets the paint can swinging, and he stands back to see what will happen. A form of deism might be consistent with that. I sometimes think that this is Ken Miller's view of how theistic evolution functions, and that he kind of divides science from salvation history, if you will, and God's activity is observable in revelatory activity and in the person of Christ, but not observable in creation itself. Strange view, but I suppose you could call that a form of theism piggybacked on top of naturalistic evolution. So those seem to be the options. The fundamental question, though, is not one of compatibility between intelligent design and theistic evolution. Of course, there are certain forms that are compatible, certain forms that aren't, but of truth and its discernment. So how can we tell what really happened needs to be the focus. And Walter's telling me I need to wrap things up, and thankfully I'm about at the point where I can wrap things up. So insofar as that question's empirically investigable, we should be able to distinguish among those four options. So. And that challenge has been taken up on the ID side in various books and continues to be pursued through the research of Biologic Institute. You're going to be hearing from Doug Axe and Rick Sternberg tomorrow morning. And you'll also be hearing from Bob Marks and Bill Dembski on the side of mathematical analysis in relationship to algorithmic complexity and evolutionary algorithms. So, thank you.
So, just in case you're curious, there's a few slides I disagreed with, particularly, you know, on about that on science, some of the junk DNA stuff. I would have some disagreements about where I think the science is headed. On the larger structure of these myths, I agree a lot with what was said, that there are misconceptions out there about ID, and again, true about some of the statements made some of the time, but not true as a general rule about ID. So now let's think about theistic evolution, and if you're wondering how I'm going to define it, it's pretty much what you saw for definition two of you had up there, that God was active. I'll say a little bit more about that, but not in a scientifically detectable way. Another way to define this would be theistic evolution refers to and this is going to narrow it down from all versions of theistic evolution out there. This is what I'm going to talk about that I happen to hold within this range, and I know plenty of other theistic evolutionists who do. A set of beliefs and arguments that God chose to govern pre-human biological history through ordinary natural processes without using scientifically detectable miracles. Now, note the restriction to biological history. I'm not talking about theories of cosmological evolution or human social evolution. And note the words God chose. Now, some advocates of deism or process theology or panentheism or liberal theology might call themselves theistic evolutionists and say God had no choice but to act non-miraculously. And I'm not discussing those versions of theistic evolution. I'm discussing a version of theistic evolution held by many Christians with more orthodox views on God's sovereignty and governance, in which God was fully capable of performing scientifically detectable miracles or scientifically detectable guidance during pre-human biological history, but chose not to do so. Note also the restriction to pre-human history. Theistic evolution advocates who take a more orthodox view of God's sovereignty typically say that God did act miraculously in revelatory ways in human history. I know a lot of people who prefer the term evolutionary creation for this view. I do too, but since theistic evolution is a more common term, I'll just use that. All right, so where was my point? Okay, so again, I'll start like I did with ID. In recent years, certain criticisms of theistic evolution are frequently repeated in books and articles and blogs and email lists, and I believe these criticisms are unfair because they oversimplify theistic evolution, and they're overgeneralized to apply to all theistic evolution advocates. I call them myths. Myth number one, theistic evolutionists don't confront atheism. Myth number two, theistic evolutionists embrace methodological naturalism and science because they don't believe in miracles or are embarrassed by them. Three, theistic evolution is essentially deism. It doesn't have God acting as creator in any meaningful sense. Myth four, theistic evolutionists support evolution because they're worried about their jobs or their scientific respectability. These myths are common because at least three of them are true about some theistic evolutionist writings and some theistic evolution advocates some of the time. But they're not intrinsically or necessarily true about theistic evolution. And I'm going to again be bold and say it's false, literally bearing false witness, to say or imply that they are true about all theistic evolution views and advocates. So myth number one, theistic evolutionists don't confront atheism. Now, some theistic evolution advocates concentrate on arguing for the scientific theory of evolution against young earth creationism or ID to Christian audiences. And in such groups, particularly blogs and email lists and discussion groups, theistic evolution advocates sometimes neglect explaining how their views differ from atheistic or deistic evolution. And if this is the only way that someone encounters theistic evolution arguments, this misconception is understandable. However, a simple review of articles and books written by theistic evolution advocates refute this myth. I haven't done a broad survey, but the vast majority of theistic articles I've read and every single theistic evolution book I've read, including some Ken Miller's books and many other books aimed at broad Christian audience, spend considerable time confronting atheism and distinguishing themselves from atheism and deism. Many theistic evolutionist advocates also give public lectures in which confronting atheism is a central point. Now, in light of all those articles and books and lectures, why does this criticism of theistic evolution keep resurfacing? I guess in some cases, critics may not have actually read the theistic evolution articles and books. They're relying on speculation or hearsay or encounters with theistic evolution advocates in online discussion groups where they get into arguments. In other cases, and this is the one that really worries me, perhaps these critics have read theistic evolution articles and books, and they simply don't recognize or remember there was this attack on atheism because it doesn't take the form they expect, namely as an attack on the theory of evolution. Now, whatever the source, in either case, it's important that critics who make this charge that theistic evolutionists don't confront atheism just become better informed of what theistic evolution advocates are actually doing. All right, myth number two. Theistic evolutionists embrace methodological naturalism and science because they don't believe in miracles or are embarrassed by miracles. Now, I can understand the concern here. Liberal theology, process theology, there is a de-emphasis or outright rejection of miracles. Many advocates of theistic evolution reject liberal theology or process theology. They have no trouble with miracles. Theistic evolution does not require a general rejection of miracles. Theistic evolution requires a much more limited claim that methodological naturalism is a good working strategy for the remaining scientific mysteries of pre-human biological history. That's really all that's required, including how first life and later developments of complexity might have come about. It's a good working strategy for the remaining mysteries of pre-human biological history. Now, advocates of theistic evolution would pretty much agree that methodological naturalism is a good working strategy for this limited area. But they don't all agree about why. And this is a source of some confusion, but it's one we have to live with. I have heard various advocates of theistic evolution suggest each of the following seven reasons, and I believe most theistic evolution advocates might agree with one or two and disagree with the rest. So let me lay them on you here. Seven different options for accepting methodological naturalism as a good working strategy for biological history. One option one might be, I expect methodological naturalism will always work in the natural sciences because I believe, primarily for theological reasons, informed by science, that God chose to work in creation only in hidden ways except for a few instances of heaven breaking into creation like the incarnation and resurrection. Option two that I've heard, I expect methodological naturalism will always work for studying pre-human natural history because I believe, for a combination of scientific and theological reasons, that God chose to govern natural history through natural processes. God chose to reserve special miracles for human history. While God could do miracles at any time, God chose to do miracles in limited contexts and particular occasions during human history connected to special revelation to human beings. Option three, I've heard. Methodological naturalism might not succeed in explaining everything about the natural world, but there's a practical reason, rather than a principial reason, for keeping methodological naturalism as a rule for science. Science has made progress over the past centuries precisely by limiting its search for natural explanations to ones involving natural immediate causes. The method works. So let's not abandon it until we're very, very sure that it won't continue to work, and we haven't reached the point yet where we're very, very sure it won't continue to work in the study of pre-human biological history. Option four, methodological naturalism might not succeed in explaining everything in the natural world, but there's a practical reason for keeping it as a rule for science. Scientists have a variety of religious worldviews. We need a common working ground. Methodological naturalism has proven a pretty good common ground. So let's not abandon it unless we're very, very sure it won't continue to work, and we're not there yet. Option five, methodological naturalism might not succeed in explaining everything, but there's a practical reason. Science is a game we play by certain rules. There's limited rules in science, and the limiting rules are we only use natural causes. We play the game. We simply remember that because science has the limited toolbox, it can only achieve limited truths. This may be the most common version I've heard. I really don't like this one, so I'm going to move on. Option six, methodological naturalism should not be considered a ground rule for science in general. If the evidence warrants it, science could accommodate non-naturalistic explanations, such as ID. However, it appears that remaining questions about pre-human biological history, even questions about the origin of first life and complexity, will probably be resolved by improving our understanding of natural mechanisms. I say this purely on the basis of scientific evidence collected so far regarding how complexity can evolve. Option seven is like number six, saying methodological naturalism isn't a ground rule for science. Science could accommodate things like ID. However, I think pre-human biological history, even origin of life, will probably be solved via the toolbox of natural evolutionary mechanisms. I say that, well, even though the science isn't quite up to it, but I see additional points of support coming from cosmology and geology, which indicate that God has tended to work this way. Now, all of these views accept miracles in human history, and several of these views are very comfortable with the idea of miracles could have happened in pre-human biological history, just that the weight is against it. So, no embarrassment about miracles here, and just as there's a diversity of views within ID on various topics, there's a diversity within theistic evolution on various topics, including this one, and I just want, in going back to the myth, critics of theistic evolution ought to recognize that there is this diversity of views. Myth number three, and this is where I'll spend most of my remaining time. Evolution is essentially deism. It doesn't have God acting as a creator in any meaningful sense. Now, I can understand the concern here. In addressing God's creation and governance, some theistic evolution advocates sometimes just write a few brief sentences about God still being in charge of events which are scientifically explainable, and they really don't go into much theological detail beyond that. So as a result, critics will see theistic evolution as kind of a weak fallback position if something like ID should fail. Now, there's a couple of issues. I'm going to say there's three issues mixed together here. The first is whether God is governing creation in a meaningful sense under theistic evolution. The second is whether the role played by random events in evolution makes it antithetical to the idea of God designing. modern life forms. And the third is whether or not God's governance of biological history ought to be scientifically detectable. So first, God's governance. Look back at that bullet point at the beginning of my talk, the front of the handout. The theology of God's governance of nature. Most theistic evolutionists would agree with each of those points, and that's what I'm interested in. Look particularly at the fifth bullet point about random events. Some would say God chooses the outcome of every single scientifically unpredictable event, and some would say the third choice here, that God does that some of the time. All right, but look at the whole six as a whole, all six bullet points. Critics who accuse theistic evolution of being deistic should reflect on how they believe God governs the natural world today in all sorts of other scientific areas. Consider the parts of the natural world studied by developmental biology, by ecology, by epidemiology, by meteorology, just to name a few areas of science. In all of these areas of study of the natural world, there's an interplay between deterministic natural laws and scientifically random processes. Now, when asked how God governs these parts of the natural world, most critics of theistic evolution, unless they really do believe that God uses miracles occasionally in all those areas, they would probably respond with a list nearly identical to those six bullet points and consider that an adequate answer for how God governs the natural world in those areas. Now, the same could be said for non-biological natural history, such as cosmology, formation of the galaxies, stars, formation of planetary nebula rich in heavy elements, planetary atmospheres, geological history of the Earth. How does God govern those things? Well, that list of six bullet points is considered an adequate answer. So when asked how God governs the physical processes and the physical history, most critics of theistic evolution, unless they really do believe that God did lots of miracles in all those places, would respond with a list pretty much like that one. So in light of this, the charge of deism really should not be applied to theistic evolution unless it is applied to every other scientific field which is studied and modeled without explicit reference to detectable action by God of miracles of some sort. All right. Chance. Is chance antithetical to design? Well, no. It's certainly possible for humans to design systems in which random events play limited role for purposes. Casinos do this all the time. Games of chance bring customers into casinos for fun and the hope that they will be the particular individuals who win more than they lose. While, of course, the odds are set so the casino gets the profit in the long run. Now, alternatively, imagine an artist could program a computer to display beautiful pictures based on mathematical equations, then program the computer to randomly alter variables in the equation so the computer displays a whole sequence of new beautiful pictures one after the other. Humans can design systems in which random events play a role to achieve a desired outcome. God certainly could as well. And most critics of theistic evolution would agree that microevolution works exactly that way when species adapt to changing environments. So, there's still a question whether this could be applied to sort of the macroevolutionary scale and still have God achieve God's desired outcome. So, I like to break this into a scientific and a theological question. The scientific question is, assuming that evolutionary mechanisms can account for biological history, including the development of novel and complex life forms, how much historical contingency is there in the history of life on Earth? Some scientists, like Stephen Jay Gould, argue that evolutionary history is highly contingent, so if you replayed the tape of life a second time, you would get an entirely different outcome and probably wouldn't have anything like human beings. But other scientists, like Conway Morris, argue, on the basis of convergent evolution and other data, that evolution is highly constrained by physical parameters, by what is biochemically and physiologically possible, by the environment and by adaptation. So if you replayed the tape of life a second time, you'd get something that was pretty similar in all the major features and differ only in the minor details. It's an open scientific question, and the truth might be somewhere in the continuum between those extremes. Now for the theological question, and I've alluded to this one before. Does God choose the outcome of every single event which appears random? Quantum mechanical measurements or decay of elements or mutations. Does God choose the outcome of such events occasionally at strategic moments when a large system is poised to go down of one of several paths and a small random event is enough to push it down one path or another? Or does God never do such in his ordinary operation of the natural world and reserve such actions for human history, revelation, and answer to prayer? Now, some Christians prefer the first option for theological reasons, some the second, some the third. We can put these, the scientific and the theological, on a 3x3 grid. And here's my point. Critics of theistic evolution, in my experience, typically only argue against the bottom right corner of that 3x3 grid. But theistic evolution advocates hold views which cover every one of those 9 points on the grid. Now, it might be argued that the options on the bottom tier, where God determines the outcome of no random events outside of human history, is really deism, but I just answered that charge before with those 6 theological points. I'm not going to repeat that here. I want to focus on this question. Does God get what God wants out of biological history? Now, of those 9 options on the grid, there's really only one combination, the one on the lower right, with highly contingent evolution and God never selecting the outcome of random events outside of human history, that I think carries any significant risk of, that God might not get God what, the particular outcomes God presumably desires, such as intelligent beings whom God could reveal himself and make his image bearers. And I think even that one can be finessed, but I'm not going to do that here. My point is that many theistic evolution advocates hold positions covering the other 8 points on the grid, and in all those 8 points on the grid, there's just no question that God can get what God wants out of biological history. And moreover, on the top 2/3 of the grid, there's no question that God acted in significant ways during biological history so as to cause some outcomes to occur instead of other outcomes. God's action is not scientifically detectable in this scenario, but God unquestionably acts in ways to produce particular outcomes. Therefore, there's nothing antithetical with the idea of God using natural events, which appear random from a human perspective, as part of a system in which God meaningfully designs and accomplishes the final outcome. Theistic evolution can easily accommodate, and many theistic evolution advocates do believe, the idea that God achieved God's particular desired outcomes for the history of life on Earth through evolution. Okay, so what about this third point? Ought we to expect that God's governance or design of biological history is scientifically detectable? Now, this argument is one of the most common arguments I've heard ID advocates make against theistic evolution. There's a recent example on a new webpage at discovery.org on theistic evolution. I'll skim the quote for you. The quote goes, theistic evolution has proposed God who does... Theistic evolution proponents who do not openly deny that God guided the development of life typically insist his guidance was unobservable in biology. Skipping down again a bit, yet for thousands of years, Jewish and Christian thinkers maintained God's design could be clearly seen in nature from the psalmist who claimed the heavens declare the glory of God, the Apostle Paul on Romans 1:20. The idea that we can see design in the regularities and functionality of nature is clearly accepted. In fact, Jesus himself pointed to the feeding of birds and the exquisite design of lilies of the field observable as observable evidence of God's active care towards the world and its inhabitants. A very common argument. And I can understand where it's coming from. I have some sympathy with it. So how would most theistic evolution advocates respond? By saying, yes. God's daily feeding of the birds points to God's active care of creation, even though there is no scientifically detectable breaks in natural cause and effect when birds hunt for food and digest their food. Yes, the daily growth and flowering of lilies points to God's active care, even though there are no scientifically detectable breaks in natural cause and effect when flowers grow and bloom. Do you believe the sun, moon, and stars proclaim God's glory, even though we have scientific explanations for how they formed in terms of natural processes? Do you believe that the mountains, the atmosphere, the ocean speak of God's handiwork, even though we can scientifically understand their formation? Of course, we all do. So for this reason, I gotta say, theistic evolutionists find it puzzling, sometimes frustrating, that critics would speak about seeing God's governance of design in every other part of the natural world, including mountains and oceans and stars, even when there are complete scientific descriptions for their formation and functioning in terms of natural processes. And yet, some will insist that we cannot speak of God's design in biological species unless the formation defies explanation in terms of natural processes. Theistic evolutionists respond to this criticism by saying, we see God's design and care in the origin and adaptation of species in exactly the same way we see God's design and care in every other part of the natural world. All right, myth number 4, theistic evolutionists support evolution because they're worried about their jobs or their scientific respectability. I haven't done a broad survey. I can say this myth is simply false for every single theistic evolution advocate I know personally. And of the 8 myths I described, this is the one I say, just stomp it out, okay? This stomp them all out. But this one is a particularly destructive myth because it questions the faith commitment of fellow Christians. I've never seen it true in anyone I've ever seen. It impugns the motives and integrity of people who are honestly trying to do their best to understand God's revelations. So it's one that bugs me the most. All right. So, conclusion time. Skip ahead here just a bit. Ultimately, so one of the things we were asked to do was talk about can we define just a few issues that tends to separate the intuitions or the sensibilities of people who tend to lean towards theistic evolution and people who lean towards intelligent design. And that's one of the things we're going to do in the next few minutes. But where do I think this will ultimately get resolved? Ultimately, I think it'll be resolved by investigating the scientific claim of intelligent design. Right now, origins of life, origins of biological complexity are ongoing areas of scientific investigation. They are fascinating questions. Intelligent design advocates believe the evolution of biological complexity is highly improbable, and theistic evolutionists advocates believe that the evolution of biological complexity will be shown to be highly probable via the right combination of known natural mechanisms. I think that further research will ultimately settle this issue. Now, in other forums, not here today, I have defended the theistic evolution scientific claim. I have argued that the laws of nature of this universe are exactly the sort which produce complex environments over time, which allow self-assembly of more complex things out of simpler pieces, which allow transfer of information from complex environments into self-replicating organisms. I've also argued that when we look at the different natural mechanisms which can affect biological evolution, point mutations, gene shuffling, gene duplications, transposable elements, horizontal transfer, alternative splicing, multitasking of proteins, redundancy in how some tasks are accomplished, environmental triggers of mutation, RNA editing, genotypic redundancy of phenotypes, large phenotypic changes caused by mutations in gene regulators during development, population heterogeneity, changing environments, environmental overlap zones, sexual selection, extreme natural selection, rich environments rewarding behavioral plasticity, and coevolution, to name a few. When we put them all together, I believe we ought to expect the evolution of biological complexity is probable. But I hold all of those arguments tentatively. I might be wrong. And in tomorrow's session, some ID advocates, whose names Bruce mentioned, will present scientific arguments trying to convince me that I'm wrong. So, is the evolution of biological complexity probable or improbable? We're not really sure yet what the answer is going to be, I say. So, I hope each of us, whether an ID advocate or a theistic evolution advocate, holds his or her position with a certain degree of tentativeness. I hope that by clearing up some of these misconceptions about theistic evolution, that ID advocates realize they could happily embrace some versions of theistic evolution if their scientific arguments about the evolution of complexity fail. And conversely, I hope that by clearing up some misconceptions about ID, that advocates of theistic evolution realize they could happily embrace some versions of ID if their arguments about scientific evolution of complexity fail. And that's it for now. And Bruce, if you'll please come up. We could just alternately step forward to the mic. Okay. So, do you want to say one or two things you think that this has come out of this?
I'm very glad that you have phrased it as, let's continue on our respective paths and see what happens in terms of the results that are achieved by each side, and maybe one of us will convince the other eventually. I think that's the healthy approach to take to the whole situation. In regard to your classification of the nine different categories, whether theologically God determines random events and whether evolution is contingent or not, it occurs to me that there might be resources in Molinist theology for a way of conceptualizing some of this in terms of God's choice of which world to create. And given God's omniscience, he stands back, he looks at the various possible worlds that he might bring into existence, and he observes that if he creates this world as opposed to, say, that world, which he might equally realize, that he will not need to interfere in its development or be active in its development in the same way, such that left to its own devices, it will achieve his end. So that's one way one might consider thinking about some of the more extreme views of God's hands-off approach to creation, though I wonder if the development were improbable, it were a highly improbable world that God had selected, that in itself might warrant a design interest. So there's room for further discussion there. Myth four, I agree with you. I would not want to impugn anyone's motivation. All I can say from the standpoint of ID advocates is I know that there are a good number of us who have lost jobs because we have embraced an ID research program, and we've been told by various departments that they wanted to distance themselves from us because they were afraid our presence would damage their academic reputation. So there is that aspect as well that needs to be taken into consideration. But as an ID person, I certainly don't want to impugn any theistic evolutionists and the integrity of their motives for holding their position. And I think that's about it.
I'll just mention two things, and then we'll take questions. One is, I hope any advocate of ID will welcome if I or another theistic evolution provides a vigorous scientific critique of scientific claims. The junk DNA, I'd like to tear into that slide, okay?
Feel free, although I have to say I'm not the one who's most qualified to answer your objections. I defer.
All right.
It's going to be a topic tomorrow.
All right. But good. That's precisely what I want. I want to hear vigorous critiques of scientific ideas back and forth. The other thing I would point out in your slideshow, and this is true of a lot of presentations I've seen, the use of the word undirected. And I'd like to really call attention to that because, of course, your average atheist would insist that undirected is part of evolution. But your average theistic evolutionist would not say undirected. If you look back at that 3x3 grid, direction happens in at least 2/3 of it, but in an undetectable way. So I think it's fair to say that undirected is a necessary part of atheistic evolution. I don't think it's fair to say undirected is a necessary part of evolutionary biology or the theory of evolution. So that's the point I would like to make in tweaking rhetoric into the future.
Fair enough.
All right, Cooper.
The essential question is, what's the difference between ID not capitalized and ID capitalized? And I think that the essence would be whether design is detectable in nature through specific methodologies. And the ID advocates would say, yes, we can infer an intelligent cause has been operative from the presence of specified complex information that exceeds, in its improbability, the universal probability bound, or some such argument to that effect, whereas the theistic evolutionists would acknowledge small-case intelligent design behind nature, generally speaking, and in the beauty of its laws and structures. Is that fair?
Yeah.
I lay it out differently. I think the way I lay out that question is, the question of detectability, defining detectability. When I read the writings of intelligent design advocates and try and summarize them for myself, I break it into a two-step problem. The first is a question of the calculation of the probabilities. What is the probability that some form of complexity, something like we have, could evolve via known natural mechanisms? Very probable or very, very improbable? If the answer is very, very improbable, then you ask, what kinds of improbable events or situations do we say are designed and what sort don't we? And I call this a philosophical argument, although others would call it different, and I call it best inference answer, not a rigid proof, but say under certain circumstances, we say that this improbable event being intelligently designed is far more plausible than arguments in terms of, well, that was just chance or multiple universes or maybe it's just something we don't know. So it's a strong plausibility argument, and in that form I accept the structure of detectability of design.
I think that's a fair characterization. When we make a design argument, we make it against our background knowledge of everything that we know. And on the basis of what we know at a given point in time, we can say that natural processes, insofar as we understand them, are not sufficient to the generation of a particular phenomenon, but an intelligent cause is. And so we make a defeasible claim, a defeasible design inference, if you like, that so far as we can tell at this point in time, it's warranted to assert that this particular structure was the result of an intelligent cause.
A quick repeat that for the tape. Ted Davis, very knowledgeable in this area, points out regarding the myth that theistic evolutionists don't confront atheism. Some critics of theistic evolution have pretty much lived their whole life equating Darwinian evolution with atheism. So if it's not an attack on evolution, then it's not an attack. If it's not an attack on evolution, it's not an attack on atheism. That's how they've been thinking all their life, and that's the form they recognize. I think that's probably fair for some people who make this claim.
Two-part question, if I may, about ID. One is, it seems that intelligent design can be used to explain any mystery that exists at present. And so the question is, at what point along the process of study would you say that's invoked intelligent design? What's your methodology there? Part two is, if I may ask,
when you say intelligent design can be invoked, the question seemed to be, so far as I understand it, that intelligent design can be invoked to explain anything that we don't understand at this point in time. So isn't it vacuous then as an explanatory strategy, or is it? No, not at all. I would in part say that if intelligence has been detected, then we can start a process of examining reverse engineering sorts of questions and examine how it's put together. And we can expand upon that and there are all sorts of different research strategies or things one might expect to find from things that are engineered or about things that are engineered, and things that we can take from nature in terms of the design I'm not phrasing this very well, am I? It doesn't mean a cessation of research. So, for instance, there was the prediction of junk DNA. So, of junk DNA not being junk. So, if it's not junk, then what is its function becomes the question. If it's not just evolutionary flotsam and jetsam, what's it doing? How does the operating system function?